Do roll call.
That's in 48.
Chair Collins.
Here.
Deputy Chair Fulcrum.
Here.
Legislator Clinton.
Here.
Legislator Harmon.
Here.
Legislator Kitchen stated he wouldn't be here. Legislator McCullough.
Here.
Legislator Stewart.
Here.
You have quorum.
Thank you. Do I have a motion to approve the February 6, 2025 meeting minutes?
I'll move.
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
So, resolutions for March 18, 2025. Resolution 85, approving execution of a contract for $1,427,490.29 entered into by the County Liberty and Solar Liberty Energy Systems, Inc., Department of Planning and Public Works. The resolution approves a contract installation of solar panels at Golden Hill Project. It's 100% state funded. Kilowatts are listed in my table. That's a lot of kilowatts down here. Looks like about 350 kilowatts. Sorry, 550,000 kilowatts, excuse me. Yep. Questions?
That will not be tripled.
Will that amount be able to cover the entire usage for the new facility?
So the design of the solar facilities are covering the common areas in the facility, not the entire use of the facility itself. If I may,
sure.
Mm-hmm. This has been a long conversation. This is not a simple thing we're doing here. We're going to own the system, even though it's on Penrose's property. We're taking what they call an easement. We'll take an easement on their property for the system itself. We have a power purchase agreement between us and Penrose that you approved prior to this. And the same thing with the easement itself. We're working our way through this. The cost for the system is the entire cost of the system. There are rebates associated with this. The grant is for $1.6 million, as I recall, from the state. We will be able to essentially, it requires a 50% match. That match is being met by the project, not by Ulster County. So the project is entitled to, and that's in our contract, the project is entitled to essentially meet that match. Where we are right now, I just want to let the legislature know, I think it's prudent to pass this on at this particular point in time, but we do have a protest. So when the Ways and Means Committee meets next week, I believe. If that protest isn't resolved, then what we would do is remove this until the protest is resolved.
But currently, you think
you said prudent to pass this?
I do. Yeah. I think, you know, I want to give myself enough time, or give ourselves enough time, to essentially to make sure we can address this protest. If we can't address the protest, then we would basically remove and resubmit based on the resolution of that protest. There's only two bidders here, so.
Okay, thank you for that.
Is this the ground mount system or? No, well, there are seven buildings on Golden Hill. There'll be solar facilities on each of those buildings.
So I'll be good on all the buildings.
Yeah.
Any further questions? All in favor? Greg, have a motion? Motion by Greg. Second. Got the second by Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? I did forget to mention we're going to have Kai speak with us at the end of the resolutions. Okay. Resolution number 91, authorizing right to cross the right-of-way owned by Ulster County and the Ulster and Delaware Railroad Corridor, near mile point 2.8, City of Kingston, west of West Lake Lane, Kingston Plaza to Tesla, Inc. This is to grant the ability to cross the same corridor which we own with a power line that's going to go under the corridor and be used to supply power to a Tesla charger. Questions?
Why are we giving money to Tesla right now?
We are not giving any money to Tesla. The project is being done by the owner of the property. We own property here and here. We own the train corridor. I got to go through our property to get from their property to their property.
Okay.
So it's not us putting Tesla so up there. We're just giving them the right of way to pass through an electric line.
That came up at economic development and I was a protest vote, as were some of the other people here, because of Tesla and the current situation.
Mm-hmm.
So but it did pass out of economic development because of what we heard, that it might be beneficial, but I still maintain my protest vote.
I plan to vote no, the protest
vote as well on this, in light of Tesla.
Is there anybody else who could do what Tesla is doing?
This is not our contract.
Right, okay.
We did not negotiate with Tesla or anybody else.
Okay.
We're just giving them the ability to have a power line go under our tracks.
And if I may, in previous
committee meetings, they said that, I mean, we were told that that this could be used for other companies in addition to Tesla, and that there are converters available even on, you know, for the Tesla units, that you could use other manufacturers as well. So.
Because my concern is not just the optics of this, which I think are questionable. My bigger concern long term is that if we are facilitating work with a company that may put itself right out of business, then how have we actually helped anybody in the long run? So I have a couple of concerns, but that helps a little bit.
Deputy Chair,
just to verify, Tesla, through the chair to Dennis, Tesla does have charging units on that facility already, correct?
What happens, I don't believe so. So the site plan for Tesla was submitted by the plaza, and there are Tesla charging stations being proposed on the very west end of the plaza, where at the end of Schrank Drive, where it goes through, that's going to be reached by an overhead. There's already an existing overhead line over the railroad, so they don't need any permission from the county. They're going to install fast charging stations there. On the just to the west of Westbrook Lane, there's another bank of fast chargers that's going to be installed in the plaza there. In order to get power to that, they're going to go underground. They wanted to go overhead. I said no. They're going to go underground and into the plaza that way.
And does that the resolution right here, does it prevent anybody else from coming forward to put other charging units in there?
No, the county would, should there, for example, be others that wanted to get through under the railroad, the county could grant those rights to cross for those other charging stations as well, those others as well. We did ask the question as to whether or not the facility, the electric power coming off the pole underneath that property is owned by the utility versus owned by Tesla. And Tesla, the way this works now, Tesla is going to own it, which is why this is for Tesla, not for Central Hudson.
Question.
I would just add that it is the conduit, should we approve the crossing, would be placed by a directional bore, and it's a very small type of procedure. And when we do this for others, it's very, you know, there's no cost involved to the county. There's no harm other than that the plaza has connected with a vendor that we find, that I find to be problematic at present. But I think the potential benefit to the individuals who could use that charging station, and to the plaza, and to the climate, lead me to think that we shouldn't, stick our finger in the tiny little molecule of the eye that this would reach. And I appreciate people raising the concerns, but I think the public benefit outweighs the any potential. There's not much benefit to this corporation out of this, I think.
Stuart. Just to say, I think the only benefit that we could see is if the Kingston Freeman wrote a story or some other local paper wrote a story saying, oh, you know, the county legislature votes against Tesla on this. And frankly, I would like to see my name attached to that.
So there actually has been a story written that way about the meeting on Tuesday, despite the fact that the resolution was approved in economic development. So that story is already out there in one paper, erroneously claiming that.
I just like to ask a clarifying question, and I mentioned last time on the economic development, I am an owner of a Tesla, and there are other charging spots, but it sounds to me like what you just said, what Dan said, is that there will be a bank of chargers already happening. So this is for a secondary bank, and then there's a bank already not far from there at QuickCheck. So there will be access there is what it sounds like, regardless, because there's some overhead, and then this would be a second bank of chargers?
There is. The plans that were submitted to from the plaza show a bank of chargers along, if you go where Schwenk Drive comes into the plaza, there's parking right up against the railroad in that area. There's going to be a bank of chargers there. This bank of chargers is in the second or third row away from Herzog's, the design center into the area where most people from Hannaford's Park. It's that far area adjacent to that through road that goes through there. There's a bank of chargers. I don't know how many, but there'll be a bank of chargers there as well. And that's what this underground conduit's for.
So it sounds to me like Tesla already has some chargers. It might be nice to have some non-Tesla chargers nearby then, so I will be a no on this.
I'll just point out we have no control over whether or not Tesla or someone else puts chargers there. We're only going, can you get the cable or not? Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Need a motion.
Oh, I'm sorry, I need a motion. I always forget that. Is there a motion? Motion from legislator McCullough.
Seven.
Second from deputy chair. All in favor?
Aye.
I have two ayes. One, two, okay. Any all opposed? I'm going to be an aye, so it still is a 3-3. Fails.
Correct.
Okay, moving on to resolution number, I have a lot of notes on the Tesla one, 93. Approving the execution of a contract for $606,000 entered by the county with Repco Inc. This is to approve a contract with Repco for housing rehabilitation project, which assists low and moderate income houses or residents requiring owner-occupied single-family homes. We anticipate it will assist 20 households and 32 people. It's entirely federally funded. Any questions? Is there a motion to approve? You got Limina and you got Deborah.
Thank you.
Is there, again, that's a second. All in favor?
Aye. Thanks.
Okay, resolution 94, authorizing execution and submission of a grant application to New York State Department of Transportation to apply, accept, and administer a zero emissions transit transition ZETT program for transit electrification, Ulster County Area Transit, UCAP. Can someone explain this? Because I don't have a good explanation.
So this grant will cover any type of electrification at UTAP, whether it be the purchase of software, the purchase of electric vehicles, or maybe electrification of a new facility for new electric vehicles.
So the total award is $5 million, and we have a 5% match, which is $500,000. Is there a motion?
I love it. I'll move to approve.
McCall, a second. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Are you in here? No.
Yeah, I thought we were going to discussion.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
we can go back to discussion. I missed it.
Back to discussion real quick. I'm in favor of everything it's saying here, except the UCAT doesn't come to Marlboro. And I can't have, even if it was a dollar, I couldn't have my residents spending any money on something that they don't have access to, except for one day a week, which was a shopping bus. So it's the only reason why. I'm in favor of everything else that's going on here, but the $500,000 spent coming out of my taxpayers, my residents, who are also the county residents, the bus doesn't service us down there, so I have to be a no.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Resolution number 95, appointing members to the Transit Riders Intermodal Advisory Committee. We'd be appointing city resolutions, Matthew Bird, Bridget McGinn, Dylan Moscoso, Gemma, Kalita, Linda, this one's hard. Japheth Wood, Kwame Holmes, Ella Ray Condit, Rose Quinn, Anthony Thuggy. Majority legislator is Craig McCullough. Minority legislator is Joe Maloney. Is there a discussion? Is there a motion?
I just had a question.
Yeah.
I don't know any of these folks, and I
was just curious if how the breakdown goes by geographic location. Are all the people from, for example, are they all from Kingston? Are a few from Saugerties? Is there anyone from New Paltz? That was my question as to how well the entire county is represented.
Yes, so this resolution had been in Public Works, Capital Projects, and Transportation last year, and Legislator McCullough and I interviewed these individuals and reviewed their resumes. There were two that we didn't interview, but that we know individually. They're really strong candidates. They come from all across the county, including the western part of the county and the southern part of the county, and they have a variety of skills. We had anticipated that most of them would be focused on the transit aspect of the committee, and indeed they all are interested in that, but a couple of them are people who use bicycles for transportation, so that also cover the intermodal aspect of this. And so Legislator McCullough volunteered as a crossover on those two committees to serve this group, and I'm happy to help out for the continuity of passing it on, as it was passed on from the prior chair of Capital Works, the Public Works, Capital Projects, and Transportation, Laura Petit, in the year prior. So we hope that this is a successful landing with Housing and Transportation and Chair Collins. These applicants are really a wonderful group. And during the interviews, we kept asking them if it was okay. We kept adding them to the Zoom meeting that we were in. And so they actually have now met each other, and they worked very well together in that ad hoc kind of forum that we set up for them to meet each other.
Great. Are there two vacancies still existing for two new people?
I actually was going to suggest Legislator Corcoran, perhaps you would have somebody you'd like to specifically have on this.
Or if it's me, did I hear this from Betsy?
You beat me to the punch, Lucy.
I will look into that.
Is there a motion to approve? Motion. Got it. You got them. Eric, Stewart.
Thanks.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 And thank you to Legislator Mellon for that.
And if you could add my name as a sponsor of this resolution, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay.
New business.
Perfect.
You're up, Kai.
Okay. So
This is an informal conversation. We don't have anything for the committee now. That's right. The resolution for committee next month. So we wanted to come talk and brief the committee on what we're thinking. But before I jump into what I'd like to talk to the committee about, I just want to provide a little context here. First, 2023, we're awarded in partnership with RUCCO for the Plus One ADU program that hopefully everyone is familiar with or aware of. And that that is grants of up to $125,000, but in direct assistance, it's really $112,000 for construction of a new accessory dwelling unit or rehabilitation of a portion of a home to turn into a unit. That program is going very well. We were awarded for $5 million for round two, so we've got 52 units to build, and we have another, I think, $3 million awarded for round three for municipalities that didn't weren't participating in round two. So it's quite a bit of money to spend. The program has been going so great so far. We probably have 6 to 7 in construction right now, with another maybe 10 to 12 close to construction or through approvals. One observation we have from round one specifically is that the state put out this funding for $125,000, assuming that would cover the development of an ADU or close to the development of an ADU. Once we've gotten into projects and bids and estimates and costs and everything like that, we're seeing a range from $100,000 to $200,000 and upwards of $200,000 for bigger new standalone detached ADUs. And so we were kind of in a bind there in terms of wanting to support these property owners that earn 100% or less of the area median income. A lot of them are fixed income seniors who are worried about their property taxes, who need an additional source of revenue. And so there's this kind of sweet spot of folks who are interested in doing it, who meet the income qualifications, but feel secure enough where they're not putting themselves in at risk. So that's the first piece of context. Please.
Could I bring up a question there?
Sure.
So are all of the people who are funded using the preset design that was available?
No, we've got a couple that are using that design. We posted the information and the design for everyone who submitted for that design competition. There's folks who are using for the other runner-ups, non-winners, and then some folks that have just gone out on their own and hired an architect or a contractor to build the unit. So there isn't one set design that they have to use.
Okay. So is it that they've then designed something that's bigger and there's a match for this program anyway? So if they design something that's bigger than those templates, let's call them, or models, then wouldn't it make sense to just have them put in a bigger match if they are designing something more?
Yeah, right. So I think the piece about like the size of the unit is not necessarily the
increase
equivalent with the cost. Right, you could have a 500 to 600 square foot unit and still just site constraints, characteristics of the house that puts you at $150,000 to $160,000.
Septic, water, working areas, those kinds of things.
So if you're a fixed income or limited income property owner, you receive the grant, this would really help you, but you don't necessarily have savings to put in for that match, or you're not credit worthy, you don't have enough income to go out and find a construction loan. That would fill that gap. Really, we want the project to happen, and a lot of the homeowners are one of the barriers they're facing is finding funding for that gap.
I see. So if this is too far ahead, then just push it back to when we're actually doing problem solving on it.
Yeah.
But my personal view would be that if we could write that so that we don't put money to towards people who made a bigger, better unit, and it goes to unexpected difficulties in constructing the small, you know, modular type approach, then it seems to me that it benefits us to have that additional housing in those complicated situations.
Absolutely.
But not giving somebody a benefit beyond the benefit that we thought was returned to the county by having an additional housing unit available.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So I think that is partly being addressed by RUPCO's kind of hands-on approach to from the beginning of design all the way through to construction and permitting. They are educating the homeowner on the limitations that they have in terms of how much money you're going to get and how much loan you will have to make up for that. And so they are having sobering conversations with the homeowners about what it's really going to cost to build this and what the intent they have for the project. Before I go into a couple other questions, I just want to bring us up to speed or where we're at now. The other half of this is that in 2023, we created the Housing Action Fund, $15 million for affordable housing projects of various types. And then I think 2024, the legislature passed the increase in the hotel occupancy tax, and a portion of that, a quarter of that, will go into the Housing Action Fund. As we are thinking about the long-term sustainability of the Housing Action Funds, we're drawing down potentially $3 million each year. You know, that could go pretty quickly, and then that funding source would not be there over the long term. So we're having discussions with the Housing Policy and Oversight Committee, which we've discussed this with, about ways that we can expand the opportunities and services or tools that are provided under the Housing Action Fund. And so what we are proposing in the resolution is to an amendment to the resolution for creating the Housing Action Fund to explore an opportunity for an accessory dwelling unit revolving loan fund. And the idea here is that some folks are going out and getting financing, but they don't have the income to meet that gap. And so this is kind of a public source or a semi-public source of funding. We can take a little bit more risk. We can provide lower interest rates, which make the difference between a homeowner getting a loan or not. And it is not exclusive to the plus one ADU program recipients. It's actually a way for us to, we've kind of socialized this idea of accessory dwelling units. And now how do we bring it to a wider pool of residents who are interested in building an ADU? Maybe they make more than 100% AMI, but they still want to provide affordable housing to folks. And so this is the idea that we're presenting to the committee. We have a request for a proposal that we could bring to the committee and other committees next month. We were curious to hear your feedback on the idea. You know, part of the RFP would be what we're requiring is that it's a nonprofit housing support organization of some sort and a financial institution that are teaming up together to do this so that one is not overwhelmed by the other, but this is a loan product essentially, and so we want a financial institution, local financial institution with a lot of experience to help us administer it. I know we're talking about revolving loan funds of all sorts these days, but this is one that would really help a lot of the homeowners who are getting those plus one ADU grants and would expand to any homeowner who's interested in building an ADU. And that's it. Go.
Yeah, thank you. So why are we having this discussion? The original resolution that set up the Housing Action Fund and put it in an assigned fund balance did not contemplate loans. It contemplated grants. And so to be completely transparent with the legislature before we began a discussion about loans, we wanted to make sure that we could look at those standards for the Housing Action Fund and include a loan portfolio. The loans that we're talking about are gap financing. We're not loaning people the money for the project. We're loaning people money for the portion of the project that they can't borrow the money for.
Or don't have grant funds or other forms of income.
So we've done gap financing before with CDBG money with respect to home ownership. We've done that in an area between $25,000 and $40,000. And this makes some sense relative to the idea of trying to get ADU units built countywide. A couple of things you should understand. ADU units, even at $200,000 a unit, are substantially cheaper than tax credit units at $400 and above a unit. The approval of ADUs in many communities are as of right or site plan review only. So the ability and timeliness of terms of getting this done is extremely quick. The focus on ADUs is also not disruptive to neighborhoods. So you're not dealing with major zoning challenges, et cetera, relative to that. The loan program would essentially follow the lien on the property associated with the affordability of the unit. So the unit, the homeowner doesn't have to have an income responsibility. The unit has an income restriction associated with it, and it would be leaned accordingly, right? So the current one is 10 years
plus one ADU program.
10 years. So those are the kinds of things you're looking at. Let me also give you another statistic. Not that this is going to be the same next year, but currently the numbers that we're seeing with respect to hotel and motel tax that would be associated with the Housing Action Fund, given the legislature's decision to dedicate 25%, is probably in the neighborhood of between $1.7 and $1.9 million. So that will refurbish the Housing Action Fund. We've currently granted $2 million out of that fund last year. We will be releasing on Friday the next NOFA for the Housing Action Fund for this year. So with that all in context, what we're trying to do is set you up for a conversation for next month, hopefully, that there's a resolution that comes in that talks about establishing a revolving loan fund for ADU units to provide gap financing for an affordable unit with a focus on 60% AMI for affordability.
Let's add one more thing too. This is not, sorry to steal your thunder, Dennis. This is not a new idea. We're not the first one creating this. This is something that exists in other states. Montpelier has Vermont has a statewide ADU loan program. Rockland County took $13 million of their ARPA funds and put it into a housing revolving loan fund rather than spending it down there. Which is an allowed use, so they're giving out that money and then they're giving returns so they can build more and more projects every year. There's a number of programs in California that are doing something very similar. So we feel confident that the model works. I just want to add that.
Sure.
I have just two quick questions. One of them is, you know, we're considering putting tariffs on lumber coming in from Canada, and that could dramatically increase the cost of construction. And I was wondering if you've kind of considered that possibility in your projections.
I would say that, you know, we are all in for a lot of different programs, uncharted waters in terms of what's going to happen at the federal level. Today's tariffs, tomorrow's no tariffs, there's tariffs on something else. So the short answer is we're well aware that there are external forces that may, in terms of construction labor is also an issue that may impact what the costs are. But again, we're funding a gap. We're not funding, you know, we're not funding the unit as a whole.
If I can just add, and I don't want to dive too deep into this here, there is another, we received a grant from Empire State Development for a study to look at modular construction
overall in Ulster County and the potential for bringing more of that modular construction and the facilities to Ulster County as a way to more locally source where those units and in all types of development too. And I would imagine that part of that is also thinking about sourcing materials more locally to bring down costs.
So you anticipate doing more of like modular type construction?
Yeah, or how do we as a county support those things? And material costs are obviously a concern there. And how do we, you know, shipping costs, all just to
bread. And in the financing?
For this construction, my concern is that, you know, some of these might end up as being short-term rentals as opposed to, and so the financing kind of covers that, yeah. Correct?
No short-term rental, yeah. Affordability at the 80% AMI is a cap with priority for the 60% AMI threshold.
So that those concerns have already been built into the equation.
And and in some places, like the city of Kingston, new accessory dwelling units cannot be used as short-term rentals and were encouraging other municipalities.
And what's the enforcement mechanism? I mean, you just simply look on Granicus to see if that address has popped up as being on Airbnb, or I mean, how do we actually know?
For short-term rentals?
Exactly.
You mean for this loan program specifically?
Or
in general?
Or say you just in general. I mean, say that someone, you know, applies for this program and they build an ADU and, you know, grandma lives in there for 3 years and then grandma dies and then, you know, then what if it becomes a short-term rental?
Right.
That's my question.
Yeah, so the way that we've kind of proposed it is that it's a nonprofit housing developer, organization, and financial institution. That housing organization side of it will work on a pretty hands-off but annual reporting attestation for the use of the unit.
Right.
You know, is it being rented? What's the rent amount to make sure you're not going over the limit? And then it being used as a short-term rental. I think we can organize with that organization on the back end to verify those things.
Right.
But it would be monitored by that housing organization.
Yeah. It's like I said, my concern was not in the immediate
future, but it's like, you know, down the road.
Yeah.
So what's happened in the past when we've done, for example, the $650,000 contract you just approved for housing rehab, that actually comes with a filing of a lien against the homeowner for, I forget, I think it's 5 years, that basically says if you move out of the home and it's not occupied by a low and moderate income homeowner, you pay us back the remaining, that portion of it. So not the best thing to capture a payback, but that's the mechanism that you use. Is the capture, you would be responsible to pay the loan back if we caught you using it as a short-term rental.
Okay, great. Thank you for this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I know that the ADUs cannot be, those grants can't be awarded to nonprofits. Would the same be true of the revolving loan fund? Because, for instance, I know we have any number of churches that would really love to be providing affordable housing, may have an extra portion of their property or, right, like, I mean, I can think of four right off the top of my head, but they don't have the means to make that happen.
So the short answer is no and yes.
Thank you.
The north part about it is,
yes,
is ADUs have to have a primary residence, a homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
So if the nonprofit or the church has a home that is the pastor lives in, a primary residence, then an ADU associated with that would go to the primary resident, et cetera, et cetera. But if it's not, then if they want to add something onto a church or a building or something like that, then you don't have a primary homeowner. And that's not only what you see in the grant world, you also see it, quite frankly, in local regulation.
Meaning the restriction, it's not the loan, it's the zoning of your facility,
okay.
Finance. Of the,
yeah.
So, for instance, I live in a parsonage. Like, I just want to be really clear that I'm not No, yes, that's, I'm still, no, so I live in a parsonage. My parsonage is next to the church.
Yeah.
The church owns both.
Same lot or separate lots?
They're,
we can talk.
I think it depends whether you're a residence lot, residential lot, or a non-residential lot. I think that's what matters, right?
Think of it this way. In order to be an accessory dwelling unit to a residential use, you need a homeowner. And that homeowner has to live in the unit. That's the way most zoning statutes are crafted with respect to accessory dwelling units.
So then it's a no, because I don't own the home.
We
can talk about this later. I need you to hold my hand.
I won't be meeting with you to talk about it later. So I would like to say that if it's on the church's property, all as one unit, then it probably wouldn't qualify. But if the church were open to making it into a separate unit, then it might be able to qualify that way. And that would could be like a lot line adjustment for the church. Then it has the church would still own it, but it could be considered a residence. Possibly talk to the planners. That's the way I would try to do it.
And I'll just mention there are other similar loan or grant products out there from the state that might be more appropriate for like three or four rentals on a non-residential single-family home property. And we can give those to you. That might be the better option.
You're giving tiny congregations a lot of credit for having the ability to go after
them. Yeah.
We should know yes at each other for a while.
Sure. I know the answer, but I'm going to ask anyway. So
the qualification process, because this is the only question I've got, and I will answer, but I'll verify. The qualification for the ADU has to come from the homeowner. Because here's the question. Elderly mom and dad want to move onto an ADU that the kids own, but the kids have to be the qualifying number.
So no.
No? Okay.
Let's put it this way. Under the program at the state level, there's two things that happen. One is the qualifications for the income of the homeowner, and the second is the qualifications for the income of the renter.
Right.
The County of Ulster, in its work, basically added that second qualifications because we didn't want to basically, the state perceived this as essentially helping a homeowner, not concerned about what the rental rates were for the ADU. The loan program would work just in the opposite, not concerned about the income of the homeowner, only concerned about the rent for the ADU. And remember, it's gap financing. So if there's a lot of income, they're not going to need a lot of work from us or a lot of loan from us in order to make it happen. The bank's going to have to say no to the loan that they're asking for, and we can come in and fill the gap.
So the kids make $200,000. Mom and dad are coming in making $50,000.
Yeah,
they want to qualify to build this ADU on that property.
Yeah.
They're good.
Yeah, yeah. We're encouraging people who not encouraging, but we want to open it up to people who make over 100% EMI because they are they're in a better financial situation to potentially finance this without the program, but this can support in between.
And our blueprint boilerplate set of plans that we have for the ADU, you know the square footage off the top of your head?
I think that's like 600. Yeah.
600, yeah. So that's compatible at the 120 because right now building rate's 200 square foot.
Yeah.
So it's right at the 120.
Yeah. And
not including the septic, so that's where you go. Yeah. Building rate at 200 square. If you're building 400 square, then you're at 80 grand and you've got some room. Anything larger, you're pushing the limits.
And even the cap on the rental for 60 and 80% AMI right now, depending on the interest rate and everything like that, the payback period is somewhere between 5 and 7 years. So it's really not this long-term financial investment that we're putting people in a risky position for. It's just where things are at with AMI and that kind of thing. And you make money, you pay back, you have revenue, you pay back your loan, and after that affordability period, you can do whatever you want with that. For that idea.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we've reached the motion for adjournment.
Is there anything else for PCAP?
I was wondering if I could ask you a question.
Sure.
To a representative from UCAT. I was just wondering, so the one thing that I've been advocating for, and I know that Legislator McCullough is very much concerned about as well, and I think others as well, would be getting bus shelters built along the routes. And I know that, we were waiting until we got the route optimization study completed. I was wondering where we stand on that. And I also know that we have $500,000 that was allocated for building bus shelters. And so I was just curious where we are status-wise.
So right now, the route optimization study, we had a couple of public meetings and put everything out to the public on which routes they prefer. The consultants are now putting timetables together with the routes, and that's where we stand right now. We don't have an exact route, but Dennis, how much longer did we extend that?
Our answer is yes, but specifically to the bus shelter program, we heard in the public comment period for the route optimization program a great deal of concern about bus shelters and route markings. So we started a conversation, actually more than started a conversation. We have proposals from our consultant to actually inventory what's out there. Before we start putting new stuff out there, we want to know what's out there and where it is and what conditions it. So that proposal is in. We're currently looking at that proposal. Given what it's going to do, we may have to come back to the legislature to amend that contract. But yes, the short answer is yes. We're keenly aware that bus shelters are of some great importance relative to where our routes are. I would also say we're keenly aware that you can't put bus shelters every place a bus stop. And that's the other thing I think the legislature should be wrap its arms around to say that, that we think we're going to string bus shelters up Route 28 is not really a practical solution. But the idea that we can look at where our bus shelters are in regular stops where there are a number of portings and alightings, which we're going to have from the route optimization work that we're doing, that's the kind of area that you start to focus on. We still struggle with the idea of who maintains them.
And
who owns the right of way in terms of where they are.
And I would just kind of add on to that, we've had several kind of solicitations out to municipalities looking for folks to partner with us to do the maintenance.
And how has that gone?
It has not gone. Responded. Right. So we're evaluating other models for doing that and talking to other transit agencies who do it differently. So.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. So thank you.
Would you know if your consultant, when he did the route optimization, did they look at areas like Marlboro that doesn't have buses that need them? Are they taking that into account, or you just
they look at the areas that needed to be served based on both what they call a transit index and affordability, single cars, et cetera, et cetera. And then they looked at where people need to go relative to that in terms of heat maps to figure out where people are traveling to and from, and that influenced the routing. Mr. Cochran is right. There are no routes proposed for the Marlboro area except for the existing routes associated with the paratransit service and with respect to a shopping bus.
One last. How about
Sunday service?
Sunday service is, there are alternatives within the route optimization work. Sunday service is one of those alternatives that for some areas have been considered. It comes at the expense of the timing with respect to other routes. We currently run to 8:30, 9 or 10. Did we run to 10?
We run to 11.
And so the
ridership drops off significantly after a certain amount of time. So you would shorten the time that you run in order to run the other services, right? We ran what they call scenario planning. So the scenario planning basically assumes that there will be 25% more dollars available for the transit service than is currently available. Maybe a difficult assumption given what we're seeing at the federal level. But when we looked at that, that's what you're looking at in terms of where the routes go and the times that the routes run. We do have an application in for microtransit. We have not heard from that application for microtransit.
I was just actually going to ask you about microtransit. Mm-hmm. If that would be a solution for situations like Marlboro or Ellendale or elsewhere. So
we see a lot of demand for Southern Ulster County out of Shawnga into Orange County. We see a lot of demand out of Southern Ulster County from Marlboro into that area. We see a lot of demand for service into Margaretville in the western part. And we see a lot of demand for specific route services in Ellendale, Woodstock, and Kingston. So those are the demand areas that are out there. I would caveat everything I've said is that, one, it depends on the ability to obtain the buses, and two, it depends upon the ability to obtain drivers, both of which are lacking.
Yeah.
I think we put money into the budget for second persons on buses. I forget what we ended up calling them, like bus aides?
Bus stewards.
Right, yeah. Bus stewards. Has there been any movement to hire such people?
We just had the job descriptions come out to us yesterday. So
will there be some kind of announcement when
the posting? Position description, and then we'll have a posting.
Great. Thank you.
And would the bus stewards be on just selected routes? I mean, how do you figure out where to put the bus stewards?
We haven't really talked about that. I know that was something that the legislator had put together. Mm-hmm. So with just two of them, I think we would try to put them on the routes that we are having the most trouble on. That's where we would start, and hopefully maybe move them around so that even the people on those routes didn't get comfortable.
And these bus stewards would help people with perhaps physical issues, but also like security type positions as well?
They're not really secured. They wouldn't be security, but they would be trained as like security guards. So if there was an instance where there was an incident on the bus, they could use the radio to call into dispatch or be the ones that de-escalate the person from having that interaction with the driver,
right,
so that the driver can focus on driving. Because what we're seeing now...
Or interactions between
exactly,
two passengers as well.
Exactly. Because right now the drivers are driving and they're dealing with these incidents on the buses, and they have to pull over and, call dispatch, or we call the police. But in that time period, now you have two people fighting, right, and 20 people wanting to go to work.
Yeah.
So now you're waiting for the police to come, and these people, the people that want to go to work, are now 45 minutes late. So now we have a whole angry bus. So that will help to de-escalate anything going on, or maybe they, while we're still moving, can call for help. It's been trying lately.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah. Is there a motion to adjourn? Motion to adjourn by Legislator McCullough, seconded by Deputy Chair Corcoran. All in favor of adjourning?
Aye.
Aye.
Checkpoints.
Thank you.